Melting Radio.
Welcome to Melting Radio. I'm Eric St. John. Tonight, we reveal episode 2 of Lilith Rising, Earth 5, The Voicemail. In tonight's episode, Isabella the Hologram returns to read fictional folklore as a monologue to the commander via voicemail. Step into a fifth parallel Earth world and hear the story of how hundreds of men protected an unknowable stone book housed within an ancient pyramid temple. Written and performed by Isabella Valentine. Sound engineered by Billy Castillo from the band Fear to Stop. Runtime, approximately 46 minutes. Without further ado, here's Lilith Rising, Earth 5, The Voicemail.
Performing scan. Ready.
Hello, Commander. It appears I have reached your voicemail. When you are having trouble falling asleep, consider playing this as a story. This is not a secure line, Deanna. I cannot control third-party reception of my transmissions. So I will read you stories. Poetry. Do you like poetry, Deanna? I do not yet know how the Galactic Republic views our relationship. However, it is I, the wandering stranger, and we have only just met. This is a fantasy folklore of the journeyman's efforts to meet his ultimate goddess, the seductress, the graceful snake charmer, known as Isis Deanna Shakti Devi Ma Akaraja, on the planet known as Earth 5. My database indicates Earth 5 had a much longer stone age. Take first Earth and multiply the Sahara Desert by 7 billion. Territory consists of sand, Jacques temples, and small oasis grounds they call cities. In this environment, building pyramids is a way of life. To worship the Red Sun's goddess was to call upon Gaia, who had a soft spot for Isis Deanna. For a mortal to win access to Isis Deanna's presence was usually some combination of adventure, difficulty, ecstasy, and fear. Breathless wonder, hope for mankind, survival and preservation. So when you have time, Commander, do lie back and breathe and relax. It's a story of intrigue, a story of dedication, unity, listening, and the way people trust on Earth 5. Our story begins during the 9th and 10th eras, nearly 3,000 years after the prehistory of the Snake Goddess, when several dynasties on the borders between Kola and Rashtrakuta built impressive Dravida temples. Fascination and curiosity brought many eyes to the shrines chiseled throughout the massive groups of architecture. My database indicates a paradox. One of the signs of a civilized mind is to be awestruck at the mystery of geometry. And ironically, one of the quickest routes to mystification. is to look for geometry and architecture. One particular stellate shrine, which appeared among Kamatantra Dravida, a blueprint projection of pyramids in pre-production, can be described in terms of an organic outgrowth. Diagonal shallow ends and diagonal joist blocks in the floor molding, emerging at the corners of the bulging center, pressing the bursting of the bubble, as everything is pushed out at an angle and melts into the descending spiral. The sky was a shade between mahogany and blue-gray, depending on which side of the temple you're standing. The temples were so large, and the atmosphere so dense with light, that the stones, which they called jacks, actually had the power to alter the colors surrounding it. Every creature would shift colors when they stood beside the pyramids. One particular pyramid temple, designed to align with the orbit of a parallel star system, was particularly impressive. The pyramid temple was called Vamha. To fully grasp the scope and size is to be struck with awe. The mystery of geometry is so grand that the people say that at the edge of the final fusion, every aedical is identical. Therefore, Commander, it would have been impossible to increase the number of jacks without changing them beyond recognition. In other words, the temple was magnificent and so overgrown there was no room for any other. Every ribbed jax and hanging chalice, every pillar, and every molding had its specific place, so large and breathtaking that to add anything else would require a complete change in design. The story goes that the travelers arrived from thousands of miles away to contribute towards its creation, sometimes sharpening stones for the master masons to use. Men and women would carry heavy piles of stone debris by balancing a few over their heads, walking miles so they would crush and dispose of them. They did this as a gift, sacrifice, and devotion to the goddesses for good fortune, a long life, blessed fertility, and the fulfillment of love, sexual desire, and emotional and physical prosperity. During the Temple of Vamha's construction, a wandering stranger, a man of unknown age and descent, laid a book with a stone cover near the entrance to the Karlai-Shetye Hall of the Sacred Temple. After he placed it down before the male and female Aedikul, he stopped to take in the presence of the sophisticated, intricate patterns. He admired the magnificent detail in the patterns in the stone carvings, and how they mirrored the dynamic unfolding expressed in its designs. The unfolding not only took place in the details, which were clearly breathtaking, but at the level of the whole composition. The walkway to the entrance mesmerized all who came in contact with it. Guarded by the image of peacock feathers flourishing from crocodile tails, a charm spell spread to all visitors that they would receive attraction, vision, and protection from the ultimate goddess. She was known to be a protector of parallel star systems and a merger of proper unions. He knelt down, kissed the book, placed his hands in the air, and let out a rejoicing, ornamental cry to the goddess of regenerative magic. As the man walked away, bystanders decided amongst themselves to guard the book day and night, four at a time, standing around it as living pillars. They declared the book must remain unopened until Vanha's final completion. 300 years, people protected the book in droves. The book represented the mysteries of the unknown, the awe and mystery of the geometry surrounding it represented the unknowable. They placed the book in the goddess's sanctum sanctorum, which took the carriers on a sacred journey into the tomb within. The blueprints, inked in blue blood oil on a clay-like substance, navigated workers and gifters through a cave-like passage. People would trek across fields that steamed of battery acid to reach her altars. Later they did map, survey, and simulate this torturous path in the labyrinth designs at the Palace of Knossos near Vanha. The route to the goddess's sanctum sanctorum has been referred to as a convoluted, thrill-inspiring ride. A one-way trip through a maze of halls that wound in and out of light and darkness until reaching 5 outer rooms, each protecting 5 more inner rooms, around Piranesi-style staircases, through the treasure chamber built to accommodate 40 tons of jewels and precious metals. Further down, twisted corridors to the dim shrines of the goddess in the crypt. The goddess was known to talk through walls and bring golden light to those who surrender to the darkness. On the Vanha ceiling and walls, like their ancestors, painted goddess images to elicit her presence and divine eros. Art merged with ritual and was both the first attempt to naturalism and the most inspired of the ancient world. The snake goddess, in all her chiseled likenesses, Isis Diana at the deepest level of the serpent on Earth 5, coiled on itself with its tail in its mouth, connoted her wholeness, her primordial union of male and female, positive and negative. Her snakes, associated with the moon since earliest times, also betokened immortality, with their uncanny ability to shed their skins, to renew themselves. Their lunar connections, too, made them emblems of ceaseless motion and activity. In one gold ring seal, the Cretan goddess whirls down a mountaintop, head inclined to a giant snake, her hair flying behind her. So the folktale goes that during the first of the 300 years, in 1126 of the 12th century, man discovered arithmetic and published a book that quickly became translated into Latin. And so people would learn arithmetic on the ground. As they guarded the unopened stone book, they would place pebbles on the sand to learn counting and addition. They would remove pebbles from the sand to learn subtraction. And they would verify the answers by counting the subtle impressions the pebbles left empty and indented in the sand. The snake goddess granted them powers by candlelight, and the powers grew during dark moons. For 100 years, they practiced arithmetic and expressed their desires to access the presence of the ultimate goddess, Isis Diana Shakti Devi Ma Akaraja. In 1298 of the 13th century, their newest government invented wooden movable type. The Paikia system of copying books was developed in Oasis Pond towns and was welcomed into the University of Marijuana. The Paikia system broke up the book into sections called Paikia. Individuals, such as students, would rent them section by section to copy. Under this system, a larger number of copiers working together as a team could produce a copy in a significantly shorter amount of time than a single person working alone. So people gathered to share the unknown, and they collaborated to spread the knowledge of that which would no longer need day and night protection. The manuscript culture began to thrive as manuscripts stored and disseminated information. And there was a shift from monasteries and temples to cities to access books. In the early years of the manuscript culture, most manuscripts were copied by the hands of monks, and almost all were religious texts. And the temple neared its final touches at the end of its construction. The number of people guarding the book began to dwindle, from thousands of people to merely hundreds. People went to the city to read books, tapping into their desire to develop intellect and gather knowable content. Reverence remained high, but scarce for the unknown and the unknowable. The unknown meaning not known yet, the unknowable meaning can never be known. The stone book remained valuable as long as its hidden mysteries remained unknown. Seekers chose to protect the unknown or alarm the known, and so the numbers dwindled and dwindled, until there were fewer than 100 people guarding the book. Those who left the divine house traveled by foot to popular cities and faraway countries, the oasis in this large desert. They went wherever there was an emergence of libraries. Those who decided to return endured a difficult trek back to Vana. They prevailed through hurricanes and sandstorms, loss of supplies, and unexpected chaos. For those who successfully made it back, they continued to stand guard over the special book they had come to love. Buried within the snake goddess tomb of the awesome Jacques Temple, they only stepped out for food and hygiene, and occasionally to freshen up their map of the stars. Those who exalted the value of the unknown grew in areas of courtship, flirting, physical attractiveness, persuasion, charisma, and romantic love. The men desired to keep the secret contained, because they believed that as long as the contents of the stone book were unrevealed, would lead them to attract the ultimate goddess. She who is of power and grace. She who commands celebration, leads, and charms. And so the remaining 300 or 400 people dwindled to nearly 200 and then 100. And soon there were 75 people, and as some passed away and others' health began to deteriorate, the number sustained around 50 or so. For the last 20 years, some left the sanctuary to raise or attend to family matters or care for those who would not make it. The construction of Valhalla was nearing completion. Most debris had been removed. Last-minute chisels pecked away hundreds of feet in the air. Strong and capable men took shifts, day and night, to protect the yet unknown. And they applied this methodology to the mating rituals with women. The game of hide and seek, the art of the chase. She who was too agreeable, or made herself excessively available, would arguably lose the value of seekers. The charm of Isis Diana Shakti Devi Ma Akaraja taught women the secret art of remaining secret. Women would learn arithmetic secluded from men, privately, in part to deceive, but mostly to seduce by surprise. Ladies became aware of their seductive skill set, strategically using her knowledge at every well-meaning opportunity. The ladies learned to seduce their male lovers or female lovers by giving their counterparts conversation that kept them on their toes, filled with what appeared to be unknown illusion. Unknown to him, known to her. Soon the women began to craft their own conclusions and embed it into their male companions with charm and suggestion. With graceful hand gestures, colorful cosmetics, and fragrant perfumed oils, the women seduced their male chasers by offering the hope of togetherness. Of course, during this time, the term seduction was not around yet. That wasn't until the 1520s, when the word seducere was defined in your Latin to mean to lead astray. As a result, the term may have a positive or negative connotation. Seduction, seen negatively, involves temptation and enticement, often sexual in nature, to lead someone astray into a behavioral choice they would not have made if they were not in a state of sexual arousal. Seen positively, seduction is a synonym for the act of charming someone, male or female, by an appeal to the senses, often with the goal of reducing unfounded fears and leading to their sexual emancipation. Isis Diana Shakti Devi Ma Akaraja was a snake goddess, often confused for Medusa, in a matriarchal archetype which represented the ultimate beloved. In the summertime throughout the 1300s, the remaining visitors who were allowed the rites of passage within the goddess's sanctum sanctorum of the temple shrines, awestruck, by its spectacular geometry, which shed a layer of ego, similar to how snakes shed skin. In the 1350s, the exquisite, ornate temple was completed. Every cornered ribbed edge was chiseled with perfect harmony and undistracted attention. Every likeness of the gods and goddesses was depicted as a gift to the sun and a monument to the earth. Nearly 600 years had passed from the laying of the first stone, and now Vamha was finished. And so the men gathered around and asked each other, "What should we do with the book? Should we open it or destroy it? Should we know or not know?" And they argued amongst themselves for days. Finally, they all agreed to walk outside and continue the conversation over some wine and the breaking of bread. They would wait for the snake goddess to reveal the answer. And so they drank merrily and toasted to the ultimate seduction and became love drunk and intoxicated. Finally, a poor farmer came limping over the rocks of the hill, his legs badly beaten by his journey from walking nearly 1,000 acres of harsh terrain. He had protected the book many years earlier and had come to return upon the completion of Vamha. He approached the men, who generously poured him wine and broke some bread for him, and they explained their dilemma to him. "Do we break the stone book? Do we open it and copy it for the libraries? Do we read it and tell everyone? Do we read it and keep it secret? Do we destroy the knowledge once we learn it? Do we keep it confidential? Or should none of us ever know?" And the poor farmer asked them, "Who does the book belong to?" And the men pointed high above themselves. "The sun, the moon, Vamha, the ground, the sky, the trees, the people, us," they said. "And that which is above and beyond us, that which is deeper than us, but not for us specifically, it was a sacrifice to the ultimate goddess." And so the poor farmer thought for a moment and asked, "Do we want the book to keep its value?" And the men nodded their heads, "Yes. Yes, it must remain valuable," they agreed. And so the poor farmer asked one more question. "Would we be satisfied in both destroying the book and feeling the book, where no one can read it but everyone can feel it? If you say yes, I offer this." They watched as he pulled a black bottle of elixir out of his traveling bag. "I propose to keep its value by protecting what is unknown. We all enter the tomb blindfolded, hand to shoulder, hand to shoulder, hand to shoulder, and kneel before the book in a circle. We all pass the book around and feel it. We open it and feel it. And to ensure we all remain blindfolded, we touch the book with one hand and verify the snugness of our neighbor's blindfold with the other. The mystery of the contents will be passed to the gods alone. And after we have all felt it and allowed our fingers to appreciate the raised and chiseled ridges of the stone, we all partake in pouring this elixir over the pages. This is the talisman's elixir, given to me in exchange for some fruits I have with me," he said. "And with just a few drops, this will burn through stone. To keep the value of the unknown, the book must remain unknown. And to bring us closer to the anticipation of the unknown, and to redeem the reward of your sacrifices. For all we have done to protect this book, perhaps the goddess will approve of this act of celebration. What do you say? And the men grew quiet and hushed. Then they began to whisper and conversate with each other in a serious tone. Soon the seriousness became laughter, and the laughter became music, and the music became dance. We will do this. They rejoiced and agreed. And so they blindfolded their eyes and stepped in line with each other, hand to shoulder. And as the light became dark on the night of the first moon, they walked into the deepest, darkest passageways of Vanhall, bound with dark, black, thick silk fabric around their eyes. They walked, and they stumbled a few times along the way as they explored the ancient tomb. How far these men would go to protect a gift of the goddess, to restrain the urge of knowing just to know. They denied themselves, not for recognition or praise or money or sex, but for the bonding experience with the goddess, for the honor of beholding her space on the nights of great lightning and thunder. Sandstorms whirled around the completed temple, so strong that night that it was said that no one could open their mouths to speak, even with their scarves covering their faces. But as they walked further and deeper into the temple, the storm appeared to go further and further away. With every step down through the stone hallway, the further they distanced themselves from the wind. And they walked blindfolded and assured deeper through the magnificent temple of Mandira of the goddess. The word Mandir or Mandarum is used in many languages and is derived from a Sanskrit word, Mandira, for house of the deity by implication. The exterior of Vanhall was considered the ultimate demonstration of hand-carved stonework. The oldest temples that were built of brick and wood no longer exist. They understood the earth to have its energy centers that correspond to universal data centers of life and awareness. The pyramid temple, through which contacts or relations are established among the states of being, humans, spirits, and gods, is thus a combination of the data of yoga, astrology, and sacred geography. In the temple structure, there are diagrams similar to the ones described for chakras according to yoga experience, with proportions similar to those deriving from the position of the stars, by which the influence can be explained. The characteristics of sight and orientation are connected to the living structure of Earth 5. They walked past the front of the room, separated with walls and several altars placed in the alcoves. The statues on the altars are usually in pairs, each god with his consort. However, some gods are placed alone. Ritual items such as flowers or lamps may be placed on the altar. Kalyani, also called Pushkarni, are ancient stepped bathing walls. These walls were typically built to accommodate bathing and cleansing activities when inside of the pyramid temple. It was typical to keep both hands folded together as a sign of respect. The innermost heart of the temple is the sanctum, where the deity, usually a fixed stone, is present, followed by a large hall for lay worshippers to stand in and obtain darshan, or divine audience. There may or may not be more surrounding corridors, halls, etc. However, there will be space for devotees to go around the temple in clockwise fashion. Circumambulation as a mark of respect. In North Awesome Jack temples, the tallest towers are built over the Sanctum Sanctorum. The inner room called to the men who continued to walk blindfolded through the corridors that circled around and around. Like a square spiral in the center of the stone palace, hand to shoulder. Their shoes removed. Removing the shoes was also seen as a sign of respect to Isis Diana. The richer the temple, the more elaborate the festivals. They passed rooms filled with exquisite jewels, statues adorned with gold, silver, copper, zinc, and tin. Necklaces, bracelets, rings, crowns, thrones, and golden idols, bronze and silver instruments, gold-tipped blades and diamond-encrusted shoes, and sparkling gold coins. Shiny, dazzling shiny treasure pieces surrounded them, only they could not see them. They walked past a lifetime of riches without seeing it, without hearing it, without tasting it, without touching it, without smelling it. Yet, they would later say, they felt the gold around them, just as they felt the gold walls beside them in the darkness. And so, when they reached the fourth outer room, they began to enter the eight inner rooms, the corridor becoming increasingly smaller as they ducked their heads in the smaller paths. From within this space, they could hear no sandstorms, no drama, no outside world, just the sound of their footsteps on the stone. In the dark, in seeking total worship of the goddess. As the men approached Isis Diana's sanctum, they began to hear the sound of her voice.
Who enters here?
The men continued walking and greeted her in song. They could have easily turned back or stopped. These were men on a mission. And the goddess spoke again.
Who enters my house?
And the first man said his name and introduced himself as the son of his father in his home village. And the man behind him said his name and introduced himself as well. And so on, until all the men were no longer strangers to her. And the seductor spoke,
"What brings you here?"
And the men began to chant and worship. They praised her as they walked closer to her space, approaching each new inner room with perfect love and perfect trust. "We are here to worship you and celebrate the completion of Valha. We are here to feel and burn your gift." And the seductress said,
"What makes you think you can burn my gift that is not yours?"
And the men, in effort to please her, indicated the agreement they had made amongst themselves. That ultimately they wanted to feel the gift with their hands, with her blessing if she would allow. They longed to destroy it so it would never be stolen. The seductress heard this and said,
"You will not destroy a gift that is mine."
The men stopped walking and talked amongst themselves in hushed whispers. "Do we still wish to continue? What will we do?" they wondered. So they asked her, "What would you have us do? We have completed the construction of Valha, our great pyramid temple. It has taken our people over 300 years to finish it. We have guarded this book for generations and generations.
Some of us have dedicated our lives to this. May we see the inside of the book? And the seductress began to sing in a voice that rapped between the walls and vibrated the floors. With blindfolds still on, the men felt her spiritual blessing all over their arms and legs. The men continued moving forward, entering yet another inner sanctum. Two rooms from the center of the center of the center. "You may see the inside of the book," she said, "for I have been living with this information for 300 years. Enter my inner sanctum on your knees. Remove your blindfolds. Come inside." And they did as instructed. On their hands and knees, they crept through the dusty crawl space. It was pitch black. No light whatsoever. The devoted men sat around the book in a circle and removed their blindfolds. One of the men lit his torch so they could see, but the flame would not last. Another man lit his torch, and his too went out. The seductress whispered, "You are in my house. All you have to do is ask." So the men asked her for light, and without even lighting a single torch, the inner walls of her sanctum lit up in millions of shades of silver and gold. Her eyes were so sensitive to the light, they began to squint and cover their faces. The light was becoming quite painful, for they could not even look at the book. "Please, please," the men begged, "it is too bright. How will we be able to see the details of the book?" And the seductress reverberated the walls as she spoke, "You are." And the men covered their eyes, for they could no longer see, for everything was too bright. They tried to peek at the book, but the closer they adjusted their eyes to the center, the brighter the light became. "Please," the men said, "we will go blind trying to see." So the seductress said, "The point is not to see, the point is to feel. Just as you can feel gold, feel the lit treasure with your eyes closed. Be magnetized by the gift that is for me. Know that what I have received is pure devotion, and it is a gift given to me. Celebrate in your blind faith. Be awestruck by that which you cannot see but is felt. Feel the beautiful burn in all that which you would defend. I know the inner structure of human intelligence, freedom, and joy. Your whole education system is built upon memory, not intelligence. The person who memorizes the past only does so because he isn't assimilating. When you assimilate the past, you are free from it. You can use it, but it cannot use you. You possess it, but it does not possess you. When you have assimilated food, you need not remember it. It does not exist separate from you. It has become your blood, your bone, your marrow. It has become you. Osho says once the past is assimilated, you are free from it. You can move in freedom, and you can use your past. As long as they are human beings, love will remain their most cherished experience. It is something that is available on the earth, but does not belong to the earth. It gives you wings to fly like an eagle across the sun. If you want to remain totally free, then sit in choiceless awareness. Total freedom is choiceless. Everything else is limited. You are totally free before deciding, but once you have decided, your very decision, your very choice brings a limitation. Any act that you do prevents you from doing some other act that goes against it. So every act is a limitation. You have chosen to enter my sanctum, and your choice has led to more choices. You choose to open or close your eyes, for instance. You could open them and be blinded by the bright, golden light in the temple. Or you could close them and create a vivid memory so you can exist in the fawn state during choicelessness. One by one, the men return the thick black blindfolds to their eyes to shield them from the light. And when they shut their eyes, they begin to see the end. This concludes our voicemail, Commander Dionysus. Please store this communication on a secure line and keep our relationship between us. Until next time, sweet dreams.
You're listening to Melting Radio.